Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
At Designer Shoe Warehouse, we believe that shoes are an important part of, well,
everything. From first steps to first dates, from all-nighters to all-time personal bests.
From building pillow forts to building a life.
For all the big and small moments that make up your whole world, DSW is there. And we've got just the shoes. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love at brag-worthy prices at your DSW store or DSW.com.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
It's still under a flash flood watch. If you're just waking up and you remember yesterday, we said, well, check with the radio or TV before you head out because there might be some heavy overnight rain. Less than an inch of rain is what we've gotten here. I think the North Shore may have gotten more, but no flooded streets here, so be aware of that. However, there is a flash flood watch in effect until 7 o'clock tonight, so it's the kind of thing where they can't really tell you. Some showers could pop up that start training and stacking on top of each other. And if that happens, we get 9 inches of rain in 1 hour. The streets are going to flood. Let's hope nobody's house floods. Let's hope that doesn't happen, but you never know. Either way, be ready for it. Stephen Melnick joins us now, our friend, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He's done research into strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurements and supply chain design, but I don't think even he thought he would ever be tested as much as he is now with the state of tariffs. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. Doing very well. How about yourself?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about the state of tariffs and auto parts. And I don't know, with the pullbacks and the extensions and what the threats, and I don't know what's tariff now and what's not. Tell me how you keep track of all of this.
First of all, let's start by understanding what's going on. Because you really, in that one little statement of yours, you put about three different things. The first thing you were asking is, what's the state of the tariffs? Why are we having problems? And essentially, how do we interpret it? Let's begin by looking at the auto industry and understanding why the auto industry is really having problems with trying to cope with what's going on. For the first reason, let's understand the auto industry. The auto industry is really, really complex. A typical car will have 30,000 parts and will be produced, provided by a supply chain consisting of 18,000 suppliers. And the suppliers in the United States are located in Mexico, United States, and Canada. And you have a supply chain that's developed whose roots go way back to the 1960s, when there was an auto pact that was developed between Canada and the United States. And then it became redefined as NAFTA. And then under Trump in 2017, it became redefined again as United States, Canada-Mexico Act, which brought together Mexico, Canada, United States, and allowed for the flow of products between the three countries. The result of that was you've got a system that's taken over 30 years to develop. It's been refined. It's been fine-tuned. You've got different areas which have expertise. For example, if you want to buy engines for your Ram truck, depending upon the engine, it's either produced in Michigan or it's produced in Ontario, in Windsor. And suddenly you have these tariffs come into place. And the first thing that happens is, because of the nature of the tariffs, number one, they're not completely articulated, described. Number two, for example, one of the issues that the government had was initially it was a very simple approach. Every time you went into the United States, you got tariffed. CBP, which is Customs Border Protection, would come in and they say, you're going to get hit with 25%. Problem. Parts flow across the United States and Canada and Mexico repeatedly. In 2017, Business Week, Bloomberg Business Week did a study, and they looked at a simple component that goes into a car seat. You know, something that you sit down on, you press, and it helps you move the seat backwards and forwards, up and down. A simple thing like that crossed the border four times, which means every time it crosses, it gets tariffed. So the administration has come back, and they've tried to redefine that. And on top of that, you've got uncertainty in the sense that the administration has said that the 25%, that essentially that Mr. Trump's tariffs on passenger cars and light trucks importing the United States have now gone into effect. They went into effect on April 3rd. And a 25% tariff on auto parts shipped for foreign companies will go into effect no later than May 3rd. But the problem that you have there is there's a lot of uncertainty. We don't know if it's going to be changed. Trump is, you know, you have people in the administration saying the tariffs are set. Then you have Trump saying it's open for negotiation. And if you're an auto company and you're trying to move or you're trying to make decisions, you've got a lot of uncertainty. How do you respond? And on top of that, how do you do that with the customer? Mm-hmm. Certain companies like Ford have taken a position that right now, if you buy from Ford, we'll give you employee pricing. Hyundai has said that they will not increase prices until, I think, it's the end of June. But then once that goes away, those prices are going to go up. And you know, people think that the big three, Stellantis, GM, and Ford, are not going to be affected. And the reality is they're struggling because in most cases, a lot of their cars come from outside of the United States. And then you have companies like Toyota, Audi, Volkswagen. Volkswagen, Audi's now is struggling. They're trying to figure out where to locate production. They have a facility in South Carolina, but that's going to take about 3 years to get up and running. They're looking at maybe sharing facilities with Rivian. But they don't know if that's going to take place, and so they're struggling. Some companies, I would argue, are going to disappear from the American scene. So what you've got going on is you've got a supply chain that's complex, that's been tuned, developed, encouraged by prior governmental policy, and then suddenly the governmental policy changes, and you're trying to change a system that's been developed over 30 years. And then on top of that, you're wondering, how do we respond? We don't even know what's going to be the end state of the tariffs. Are they going to be there? Are they going to change? Is something going to happen? And so this makes the result has not been good. Ford yesterday announced their earnings, and it was not good. They made a profit, but it was a major drop from a year ago. You've got a lot of uncertainty.
Let me take a break, Professor. We'll pick it up when we come back. If you're listening right now and you don't have 1,000 questions, I would suggest you're not really listening, because I am and I do. We'll be back with Stephen Melnick, Professor of Supply Chain Management at Michigan State. He's done research in the strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurement, supply chain design. We're talking about the tariffs in the auto industry and the effects, and I don't even know how you would go about determining who owes what on what, and who is CPB, Customs and Border Patrol, or CBP, who's checking to see what. And do you go to a spreadsheet on a computer and see, well, wait, that's tariff, that's not? And then who keeps track of this? Because stuff doesn't just happen, right? Y'all have heard me say that. Maybe it's chairs at a PTA meeting. They don't just set themselves up. As simple as that is, somebody has to set that up. So when it comes to tariffs, somebody has to be keeping track of all of this, and I can't even begin to understand how they can. 622 Traffic Now, WWL. Hi, Tommy Tucker, 627 and a half. Going to spend an hour with Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State, talking about tariffs. Professor, I want to work the audience into this, okay, because you and I have conversations. Sometimes people understand, sometimes they don't. Somebody said, tariffs have been in place for decades. It's nothing new. The difference is Trump is making the playing field level. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. Thoughts?
Oh, first of all, tariffs have been in place, but tariffs have varied. For example, when Trump went in, he talked about McKinley. Under McKinley, tariffs were very high. Then you have the tariffs that were introduced in 1930, which almost pushed the prices to 50% up. In all of those, what we've seen is you're really bringing up two issues. Number one, tariffs are in place. Most countries have tariffs. The problem is that there's a difference between having a massive approach as changes what Trump has done, which affects everything, versus using the tariff as a part of, basically starting a procedure of discussing with people, how do we level the playing field? What Trump has done with his tariffs is essentially not only for the auto industry, but for everything. He's causing countries to re-examine how you want to have trade. For example, Canada, which has always been the largest customer for the United States product and has been a major supplier, is now exploring new avenues with other countries, looking at China, looking at the EU. So the question that you have is, if you want to bring attention, if you want to have people say, okay, let's negotiate, let's understand one thing. You do it behind closed doors. You let the people who are negotiators go at this. Because once you make a statement like what Trump has done, it becomes very difficult to change from it. And the effects are being felt. And the question that's going to be asked is, we've had tariffs in the past, but have they had the same impact that we're now starting to see on prices, on trade, and also on employment? Let me break it down.
Professor, break it down. We come back, all right? Because we got to stop for news 6:30, talking about President Trump and tariffs, some other texts that come in. A professor will address when we come back. No one seems to know much about the effects of tariffs on the American consumer. Everybody swears it's bad. Sky is falling. I live amongst a population of Chicken Little. Somebody else said we're in for some tough times. Sad. Somebody else texted in and said, would it be better to put quotas on foreign goods rather than tariffs? Professor Melnick will talk about all that when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7, spending an hour with our friend Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He's an expert on supply chains, EVs, tariffs, all that stuff. He's our go-to guy. Professor, before we went to the break, first of all, let me read this text. Wall Street Journal, smart people said Trump's tariffs are resulting in the dumbest trade war in history, but by all means, keep reading text from Shade Tree Economist. Well, the people that text in are listeners, and I respect them, and I want to have their questions answered by the professor as well. So before we went to break, somebody texted in and wanted to know about, would it be more simple to put quotas on foreign goods rather than tariffs?
No, the effect is the same.
Okay.
A quota is a limitation. The only difference is a tariff increases the price, and a quota decreases the availability of the product. And the issue, I'm just going to take a step back.
Sure.
And because right before that question, there was another question asked, which I thought was a really good one. And that is, the United States has been the target of some discriminatory tariffs.
Right.
When Trump rolled out his tariff program, he talked about the fact that essentially what he was doing is it was kind of a simple situation. You tariff us and we'll tariff you right back.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, by the way, we're not going to do it as badly as as they've done. And a couple of things because I thought it was an interesting question. Number one, if you go through the mathematics that Trump used, what he was really focusing on is not tariffs. He was focusing on balance of trade. Essentially, those countries that had the biggest positive balance of trade with us, that is, we bought more from them than they bought from us, he would tariff. Number two, if there is, in many cases, the tariffs that are there were set in the 1960s and 90s as a result of the negotiations across the world. And so the monetary trade, there's a thing called the most favored nation tariff, which was negotiated, and you see that. And number three, the tool that's being used, let's just make an assumption that Trump is right, the tariffs are out of control, that something's got to be done. It's really a very, very drastic tool, the way it's being applied. Let me give you an example. Let's say that, do you like boating?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's say you and I go out on the Gulf of America, Mexico, whatever that's called nowadays, and we have a boat. And let's say on the boat there's a rat. We don't want a rat, right?
No.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is burn down the boat. It gets rid of the rat.
All right.
What's the problem?
Well, we're there in the water with no boat.
Right. Yeah. What's happening now with tariffs? What are you starting to see happening with tariffs? Is countries are banding together and they're responding as a group. They're retaliating. So essentially, what you've done is you've used a tool in such a very strong way that, you know, countries are responding because they feel they have to. Good example. We have an enormous problem with China. And on this, I agree with the president. The Chinese have some issues with us. For example, when it comes to intellectual property, it's a real cluster on it. For example, if a Chinese company owns an American company with intellectual property and somebody violates it, they want to sue in the States because our protection on intellectual property is really quite good. But if it's a Chinese company that's impacted, and I've seen this happen, they want that suit to be done in China because the laws are a bit different. And in fact, there's a clause in some of the cases where I can't punish the company if that punishment results in the company being forced out of business. So, you know, when we look at China, we have a situation where there are some real legitimate grievances. What's happened now is the Chinese have come back and said, okay, we're going to put export controls. And I saw this occur this week. One of the things I do, even though I'm retired from Michigan State, is I teach executive programs. Companies come into Michigan State, and they learn from people like myself who will teach them very specific courses or topics. And one of the things they were talking about, and this is a major corporation, it's a Fortune 50 corporation, and they were talking about the fact that they're now scrambling because they need certain minerals, certain materials that are only available in China. And now China's put export controls as a result of the tariffs. And on top of that, there are components. If you take a look at Temu, Temu is now showing people that if you previously, a $2 towel is going to cost you $6. So you're starting to see prices go up. You're starting to see export controls go up. You're starting to see retaliation going up. Trump is saying, I'll increase you even more. And the Chinese are saying, fine. The Chinese are suffering, but they're willing to play the game. The government is supporting them. So, you know, essentially, what I'm trying to say is, even if the grievances are legitimate, there's better ways of achieving this. Because one of the things you learn in negotiations is you always leave your opponent, the person at the other side, with a way out. Mm-hmm. You never put him into a corner. Because if you put that person into a corner, they're going to come out swinging.
If you do, and if you do, sometimes you have to craft a way for them out. You have to solve that problem as well if you do put them in a corner. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Stephen Melnick, our guest, professor of supply chain management, talking about tariffs. We'll wrap up our conversation when we return on WWL. Time now, traffic. 6:57, 3 minutes left with Professor Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State, done research in the strategic supply chain performance measurement, supply chain design, talking about tariffs. So, Professor, in the time that we have left, 3 minutes, give me some final thoughts about tariffs. Where you see this whole thing going and heading, and is the president playing 4D chess or not?
That's a good question. That is a really good question, because essentially what's happening right now is, okay, where it's really the problem is that we've got to get a deal going with China. China provides a lot of our critical components. For example, as we make the transition into EVs, electric vehicles, we need the minerals that are coming out of China. We also need minerals coming out of Canada. We need minerals coming out of Ukraine. So essentially, we need a deal with them. But the problem is, I don't understand the logic being done. If you're trying to negotiate a deal with a country like China, you don't insult them. You don't have your vice president call them peasants. And because essentially you put the Chinese in a position where they basically are faced that you're causing them to lose face, number one. So I really don't know. It's confusion. People I've talked to in the industry would like to know where things are going. Number two, what's going to happen is the following. And I can tell you this with a fair degree of certainty. Expect that car prices will go up, not in the immediate term, because what's going to happen is companies are going to wait until May, until June, to see where things are going. But prices are going to go up. And it's not simply going to affect car prices of new cars. It's going to affect used car prices. As the car prices of new cars goes up, people turn to used cars. The third thing it's going to do, it's going to affect insurance policies. Because a lot of the parts that you buy are imported from overseas. They're produced. The third thing I can tell you is that in some ways, this is not something we can do in the space of 6 months. I remember I was talking to you about that company I was doing a program for. Mm-hmm. They have a certain supplier. That supplier, there's no other supplier like that in the United States. That supplier has a unique capability. For them to replace that supplier, to reshore that supplier to the United States, would take literally years. And so this is not a short-term solution. And finally, the final thing I'm going to tell you is the market hates uncertainty. And what we've seen with tariffs, the way they're being applied, where there's a lack of clear messaging from the administration, where one person says they're set in stone, the other one says, guess what, they're open to the deal.
A house divided. Thank you, Professor. 7:17 now on this Wednesday, May 7th. Flash flood watch until 7 o'clock tonight. Neutral ground parking allowed until 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Yes, according to Orleans Parish. And Jefferson Parish, of course, is pretty much the same as Orleans Parish, with some differences, obviously. But in terms of the amount of houses, area, land, etc., 340 miles of drainage canals, ditches, cross drains, culverts, 1,465 miles of street subsurface drainage systems, and 72 drainage pump stations. Matthew Boudreau joins us now, interim deputy commissioner with the, no, beg your pardon, Ben Lapine joins us, director of drainage for Jefferson Parish. How you doing, Ben?
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hey, I'm all right. Tell me what the situation is with the rain last night, because we were telling people to check in this morning before you left to make sure that everything was all right with the streets, and so far we've been okay, huh?
Yeah, last night we received about 1 to 2 inches of rain on the east bank, half inch to an inch on the west bank, and all the pump stations were manned. We were able to keep up. All the levels stayed low in the canals, and really, so far, we haven't had any reported issues.
Compare and contrast. Well, first of all, let me take a step back. What do you do to get ready for this kind of event? Because it's the same principle, I guess. And let me run through this. You can correct me if I'm wrong. As it is in Orleans Parish, which is the water has to get into the drain. From there, it goes into the subsurface stuff that drains into the canals. Then from the canals, it has to be pumped, correct?
Correct.
And the pumps have to be powered, right?
That's right.
Okay, and we mentioned 72 pumping stations. So when it comes to clearing the drains to get the water into the underground drainage system, your department does all of that, right? It's all one thing in Jefferson Parish. You guys maintain the drains as well?
Yeah, part with streets department as well. It's a combined effort, but we're under one public works.
So as far as you know, the maintenance on the drains is up to date and everything's flowing fine?
Correct. Yeah, we have vacuum trucks. We continuously clean and flush drain lines all year long. We dredge canals. We stabilize canal banks. As far as preparing for pump stations, we're exercising equipment on a weekly basis. We treat every mechanical issue as an emergency to fully prepare for each rain event. Leading up to the rain event, we'll clean catch basins, put all crews on catch basins, man pump stations 24/7, and lower the levels in the canal.
When it comes to powering the pumping stations, and I'm not trying to, you know, I know you're not an expert on Orleans Parish, but the Jefferson Parish power for the pumps is, and I'm just trying to do this, Ben, and give people an overall view of how pumping systems work and the difference between Orleans Parish and Jefferson Parish. The pumping stations in Jefferson Parish were built when, or how are they powered, and how is it different than in Orleans Parish? And I presume you have a working knowledge of Orleans Parish.
Yeah, so Jefferson Parish, 75% of the capacity of our system is powered through diesel engines. So each pump will have a diesel engine driving it. And as far as the construction, you know, a lot of stations came on in the 70s. We really expanded out with the 80s bond issue. Mm-hmm. And then, again, we expanded with a seal-up program in the 2000s. So we have a lot of stations that are 40-plus years old, but you know, proactively, we're replacing diesel engines, updating equipment, and maintaining the system.
What powers the other 25%? Electricity?
Electric motors. Electric motors. We have backup generators at each station for electric motors in case utility power fails.
Electric motors that comes directly from Entergy without any transmission or turbine or anything like that? I don't want to hurt myself with the words I'm using, but I'm just trying to get a handle on it.
Correct. Yeah, they run off 4160 power, and we get it. We have energy supplying it, and then if utility fails, we have backup generators and then redundant generators to that backup.
So, let me take a break. I'm getting some text about the pumping station at the airport, who oversees it, how it affects Jefferson Parish, because they had some problems there, I think, earlier in the year or last year. We're talking to Ben Lapine, Director of Drainage for Jefferson Parish. We talked to Steve Nelson yesterday. Today we thought we'd look at it from the Jefferson Parish standpoint, and we are under a flood watch until 7 o'clock. Thankfully, only, I think you said, 2 inches, huh, rain, Ben, of rain so far in Jefferson Parish?
Correct.
Yeah, so far, so let's hope it spaces out and there's no 9-inch rain event or anything like that. 722 traffic now, WWL. 726 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWO. Could be a rainy Wednesday, and Ben Lapine is with us, Director of Drainage for Jefferson Parish. They've got the canals pumped down, all the pumps. Are you got any pumps out of service, Ben, or are they all working, or anything that would affect handling any rainfall?
Nothing that would affect it. We do have two pumps out. We have portables in place. One's at the Lake Cattawachi pump station, and one is on Oak Drive in Lafitte.
Let me get to this inch an hour, half an inch thereafter. I know we always say that. I don't quite know what that means, because it depends on that. That's just an average. That, to me, is the same as saying a 1-in-100-year rain event, which I'm not quite sure what that means either. But it all depends on where it rains. If it rains 9 inches in one area and half an inch in the other, then the area with the 9 inches is gonna get some flooding, right?
That's correct. And a lot of our, well, all of them on the East Bank are interconnected. So if, you know, you get isolated pockets in Kenner or Bucktown, other stations to the east or west can assist and help out.
So let's talk about Kenner and a pumping station and what happened, and the mayor Kenner talking about some flooding that happened after Francine. Do you guys maintain, is that under your jurisdiction, the airport pumping station, or is that Orleans Parish?
It's not Orleans Parish, it's the Aviation Board.
Okay.
It's the MSY Airport. So no, we don't maintain or operate it.
So do you guys have anything to do with any of that at all, even though it affects Jefferson Parish?
No. We work with the airport. They can give us updates, but we don't own or operate it.
So that has nothing to do with Jefferson Parish canals or anything else. They have their own drainage system. And what exactly does the airport pumping system drain? That's what I'm curious about.
Well, it drains. When they expanded the airport, it was required to construct to handle the excess flow from the additional concrete. If that station wasn't there, the rain runoff would then bleed into the Jefferson Parish canals and then make its way to the Parish Line pump station just north of it.
Is that a concern that you have or not?
Well, you know, every rain event is a concern. So, yeah, I mean, all of our pumps are concerned that discharge over to the protected levee system.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we work closely with our partners, just as we do with Station 6 in New Orleans.
Gotcha. And real quick, before I let you go, when it comes to Scott Walker said this the other day about water in the streets. If the streets get flooded, unfortunately, that prohibits traffic, but still, that's part of the plan, right? I mean, as opposed to it going into houses?
Absolutely. Yep, it's street retention. There's a reason code requires you to build your home at a certain elevation. When the subsurface system is overwhelmed, it then hits the streets and facilitates its way to the major canals.
So from what you're hearing with the National Weather Service, are you just hoping like everybody else, or do you have any concerns for today specifically as we head into Wednesday?
No, I mean, we're prepared. We're ready to go. We hope it comes down at a slow and steady pace and we can keep up.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. I know you're busy. Ben Lapine, Director of Drainage for Jefferson Parish. We'll take a break. Talking to Matt Boudreau, Interim Deputy Commissioner with the Office of Motor Vehicles, about real ID when we come back. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Going to be a rainy day. Neutral ground parking allowed till 7 o'clock tomorrow night in Orleans Parish. And the conditions are ripe for storms to park or train and cause a lot of torrential downfall. We've been lucky so far, and let's hope that continues. But we'll have all the information you need on WWL. Matt Boudreau joins us now, Interim Deputy Commissioner with the Office of Motor Vehicles, to talk about real ID and more. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Well. I don't know if something was in the air yesterday, but I got a text from ttzpufjd@yamail.jp. And I also got a text from, and I'm going to tell you why I got all of these in a second, ttzpufjd@yamail. Louisiana Office of Motor Vehicles, final notice. Now, all you have to do is look at the address and realize that's not the OMV sending these notices out. But the fact that I got them from numerous sources yesterday, I would presume that I'm not the only one. Talk about these fake texts that are going out about unpaid tolls, et cetera, Matt?
Yeah, if only everyone was as vigilant as you. Louisiana Office of Motor Vehicles does not collect toll violation fees nor send text messages or emails threatening to suspend your driver's license for a toll violation. This is a scam, and certainly we want everyone to be aware of it, so I'm very thankful for you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Looking for a job is lonely. Endless searching, phone calls that go nowhere, applications that vanish into thin air. What if you could link with dozens of local companies who are hiring right now with just one connection? That's Express Employment Professionals. Find us at expresspros.com. One connection, endless opportunities, and no fees ever for job seekers. Express Employment Professionals. ExpressPros.com.
If you don't know about flyer deals on Instacart, this message is for you. Flyer deals are like strolling through your favorite store looking for deals, but you're scrolling your phone and maybe you're in bed, because getting delivery doesn't mean you have to miss deals like you'd get at the store. Like the one creamer that doesn't make your stomach hurt, or the pasta sauce you can't not buy when it's on sale. So download the Instacart app, shop flyers, and never miss a deal on one of your favorites. Plus, get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes.
How can advertising on TikTok help jumpstart sales for your small business?
Thanks to TikTok ads, I was able to open up a business with my childhood friend, get a warehouse, and even hire employees.
My name is Julian, and I am one of the founders of The Snacks Lab.
We are an exotic snack company. We had over $100,000 in sales from our TikTok ads in the first month. So our orders went from 5 a day to over 250 orders a day. You definitely have to use TikTok ads, and you gotta start now.
Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads.
Anyone who loves playing baseball or softball knows that one of the first steps in that journey is breaking in your first glove. It's where your love of the game began. Where does your child's baseball or softball journey begin? Go to playball.org to get started. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Bringing that up this morning, just we're not. If you want to look at your driver's license record, you think you might have a flag or you owe money to the Office of Motor Vehicles, go to our website, expresslane.org. You can check the status there. But again, we're not texting people asking them for toll violation money. And just please be cautious when you process online transactions. There are a lot of those scammers out there that try to collect money and get your personal information.
So I've Matt, I've we talked about this repeatedly, and I just wanted to make sure. I've gotten text toll violation notices from Texas before, where you go through toll roads and like here, I guess if you don't go often enough, you don't have a toll tag, so they take a picture. That's the way it works in Louisiana. You're gonna get a bill in the mail with a picture of you and a license plate crossing the toll thing or whatever it is.
I'm not sure. That's a DOTD thing.
I got you.
But I do know that they are aware of this toll scam, and so I would just encourage people to visit DOTD's website, and they have some more information. They're posting information about GoPass. That would be the correct toll payment information for DOTD.
All right, we'll find out more about that. Let's talk about Real ID. I purposely have not talked about this or paid attention to it, because I'm not traveling anytime in the near future other than driving, and I thought I'd approach it from a beginner's standpoint. So what do people need to know, Matt, about Real ID? Tell us what it is.
Yeah, so the Real ID is an effort by the federal government to make state-issued driver's licenses and identification cards more reliable and standardized. And it goes back to Congress passed it in 2005 after the 9/11 Commission recommended that the federal government set some security standards for those types of identification. And so here we are many, many moons later. And I think the biggest misconception right now is that the word deadline means that you can't get a Real ID after May 7th, which is just simply not true. The Office of Motor Vehicles, our public tag agents, which is our privately owned business partners, will continue to issue Real ID after today. So if you're not traveling, on a plane domestically in the near future, or don't plan to enter a federal building, there's no reason to panic or no reason to rush and wait in line at a field office. Just book an appointment when your schedule works out and go in and get Real ID, bring in the documents. But yes, again, it's a deadline. They're going to enforce it starting today, but you have plenty of time if you're not traveling anytime soon.
Book an appointment with whom?
Expresslane.org. That's our official website.
But you can't do it online, right?
You can book the appointment online. You cannot get a Real ID online. That's correct. You have to go into a field office or one of the public tag agents.
And I see a whole list of things that you have to bring in here, starting with birth certificate, ending with PA vehicle registration card, and then 1099 school records, all that in between. How many do you need to nominate? Just one? Is a birth certificate adequate?
Yeah, so it's really not many documents. It's either a birth certificate or passport. Not both. It's or.
Okay.
And two pieces of mail proving your address. So two proofs of residency. We can verify Social Security number verbally. And really, your current driver's license or ID card could serve as a proof of residency if that is your current address. So it's not a ton of paperwork. It's birth certificate or passport and two proofs of residency. And we have a checklist on that same website, expresslane.org. It's a Real ID checklist. It takes you step by step and it asks you if you have this document. If not, okay, well, what's an alternative to that? So it'll get your Real ID ready. It'll tell you exactly which documents you need to bring in to the field office when you come to get the Real ID license or ID card.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Matt Boudreaux about Real ID, Interim Deputy Commissioner with the Office of Motor Vehicles. You got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. You can go to expresslane.org to book your appointment. But unless you're really traveling, Ben, today, you'd be okay unless you're trying to board a commercial aircraft or what? Well, I'll tell you what. Let me pick it up when we come back. It's a little bit late. 752, 8 till 8, traffic now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL 757. It is Wednesday, May 7th. That's the deadline for Real ID. We're talking to Matt Boudreaux, Interim Deputy Commissioner with the Office of Motor Vehicles. Matt, while we were in the break, I went to expresslane.org, made my appointment at Oakwood for June the 11th. I think that was the first available that I could get to get my Real ID. So I will have to bring two pieces of mail, like a utility bill or something addressed to me at home, and a birth certificate, correct?
That's correct.
And how much is it going to cost, and what am I going to get for that?
So if you're eligible to renew, and if that means you're 180 days prior to your expiration date, there's no additional cost. It's the same as you would come in to renew. It's $32.25. If you're outside of that renewal period, it's a $17 duplicate fee or a change of address fee, and you'll get a credential that looks almost identical to the one you probably have in your wallet right now, except it's going to have that gold circle with the white star in the upper right hand corner. If you don't have a Real ID, it says not for federal identification. Of course, that wouldn't be on the Real ID driver's license, because that Real ID is for federal identification.
Are we taking a new picture, taking any tests or anything like that?
Yep. New picture, just to help verify the person coming in to get the Real ID is who matches in the system, but there are no additional tests or anything like that.
Somebody wanted to know about going to private places instead. Can you go to a private place if you need to get this done right away?
That's correct, yes. Many of our business partners, the public tag agents, issue Real ID. So I would just advise them to check either their website or call in to ensure. Not every PTA issues Real ID license or identification cards, but many of them do. So, yes, they have been a big help for us in this Real ID compliance enforcement date as it approaches. So, yes.
Go ahead, real quick.
You have the appointment that far. We do accept walk-ins, so if you need to get in sooner, we will fit you in. We have some no-shows, some cancellations if you need to get in.
How accurate or how long does the process take, I guess I should say?
No, it's a pretty quick process. As long as you have the proper documentation, should book the appointment, should be able to get out 10, 15 minutes.
And where would they go to find out private places if they wanted to get this done instead of going to an OMV place? How would they search?
Yeah, you can also go to expresslane.org/locations. We have a list of the OMV field offices as well as the public tag agents. You can filter by city or parish, whatever you wish.
Public tag agents, PTA. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. We'll talk to Ronald Serpas, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, when we come back. We'll also talk about air traffic control shortages. All right, 8:16 on this Wednesday morning, May 7th. The heavy weather expected, but they don't really know if it's going to train or the storms are going to park or not. You got to be ready for it just in case it does, and watch out for flooded streets. Keep in mind, flooded streets better than a flooded house. And inevitably, somebody's going to drive into these underpasses that always flood, if they do flood. And I don't understand how it happens or why it happens, but it does. I got the hiccups. Ronald Serpas joins us now. Former NOPD superintendent, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police, nationally recognized expert on crime. We always like to pick his brain on Wednesday mornings. How you doing, Chief?
I'm great, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Do you know if, in fact, there has ever been a pope named Ronald, R-O-N-A-L, your name?
I don't know, but I think there's always room for that, right?
Well,
don't you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess. But there's only been, believe it or not, only one pope whose name started with R. Pope Romanus in 897. I think in the year 897.
Well, we'll definitely do then.
Yeah.
It's
what
time.
What name would you pick? Would you use your own name?
Tommy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tommy?
I think it would be some. Yeah, I think people could imagine that in the Latin Mass. And we give veneration and support for Pope Tommy. Mm-hmm. It works.
Let's go with Tucker instead of Tommy. I like Tucker better. Hey, let's talk about the consent decree, since we heard a news story about that just now with federal attorneys early in the NOPD consent decree. But I don't know, when the consent decree goes away, I don't know that anything really changes. Tell me what this can mean to NOPD.
Well, if I saw the story correctly, there may be some movement towards leaving the 2-year compliance period. If that's the case, then it's essentially over. There'll be nobody doing spot monitoring, which is what happens in the 2 years of continued compliance. The issue with the consent decree is that it's always been this. When we negotiated this back in 2011 and 12, the key was that the city had the opportunity to do some things that had been lost over time, and that was fund those critical infrastructures of property, pieces of equipment, and funding for promotions and training and the things that you need to inspect the organization and to do those types of activities that had just been lost over years. You might remember, Tommy, and a lot of people don't, the Department of Justice began investigating the department in October of 1996. And in March of 2004, the Department of Justice closed its investigation of the NOPD, said the city did what it was supposed to do, the DOJ had done what it thought should be done, and there was never a consent decree entered. The department had successfully reformed itself, and this was during the Pennington era, the Morial era, and my era as the number two chief. So between 2004 and 2010, the department came off the wheels, and now it's back on, let's hope, and that's good for the officers, that's great for the community.
So my understanding was before this, and this goes back to the Trump administration, I guess, and DOGE, that there was going to be intense scrutiny of NOPD and things were not likely to change the way things were happening with the consent decree. Things are still not supposed to change, but there's going to be less scrutiny. So is it a concern that in the real world, NOPD backslides, 4 years from now, we get a Democratic president or somebody different, and for whatever reason, they view the DOJ differently, and we're back under a consent decree? I'm just trying to think ahead here, Chief.
Yeah, I think the key issue is that the city itself is responsible for its police department. The government is responsible for ensuring the Constitution is followed. There's 18,000 police departments in America, and there's been, less than 30 that have actually been in a consent decree about its policing practices. New Orleans was one of them. That's obvious. Let's move forward. But as long as the city of New Orleans continues to kind of keep its head in the sand on what the proper staffing number should be, you're always going to have the potential of loss of close and effective supervision. You're going to have the example when the police departments begin to shrink with personnel. Your first duty is to answer the radio, and after that, the investigations of crime, and then there's many other things. And what happened between 2004 and 2010, as some of us due to Katrina, obviously, you lost a tremendous number of people quickly. You lost a lot of supervisory opportunity quickly, and you lost those inspectional services and those quality control services, if you will, of the organization itself. So the city of New Orleans has to figure out what size the department should be, and then build to that and ensure those quality control services, if you will, like in medicine, don't stop. That'll pretty much insulate you, if you will, against a pattern and practice investigation. Final point. In American policing, or in any industry in America, things happen sometimes that the best laid plans couldn't stop. And that's not what pattern and practice cases are about. Pattern and practice cases are about what I started this answer with.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I want to talk about 20% drop in violent crime. Federal task force targeting guns and drugs. Seems like everything old is new again. I seem to remember this happening before, and it seems effective. And is this an ongoing model? We're talking to Ronald Serpas about crime in the city. 822, traffic now, WWL. 827, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Wednesday morning. Around these parts, we talked to Ronald Serpas, Dr. Ronald Serpas, a professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. But, man, he spent some time as an NOPD officer working his way up from just a beat cop rookie out of the academy to the head of the department, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police, now a nationally recognized expert on crime. Chief, I was talking before we went to the break about a drop in crime and a federal task force. It seems like every time they do that, it works. So can that be take me through what happened here, and can that be like an ongoing model or not?
Well, a task force is the perfect example of when officers are freed from calls for service responsibility, right? Which you take them out of that moment and you focus. One of the things that frustrates people, Tommy, greatly is that in the United States, less than 1% of the entire population of this country is actually in a jail, prison, county jail. Get that, right? Less than 1%. So people say, Well, if it's only 1% and the numbers hold true in New Orleans usually, why can't you find these people? Well, when you have all the demands of a modern police department and you don't have staffing, you can't pull Tommy and Newell and Ronnie and a few people and say, y'all focus on that less than 1% that's out there making trouble. Mm-hmm. That's the first issue. The second issue is, and to be honest, I'm not the first person who said this, and I know I won't be the last. The Orleans Parish criminal justice system really has a significant issue in front of keeping dangerous people in jail. I think the DA's office has made some changes, but you know a few years ago that was a very big issue, that people felt that the DA's office wasn't bringing people for prosecution. You remember the Mardi Gras issue where they dropped mm-hmm. all those cases? Yep. We have examples where judges can't seem to find a criminal even with one sitting right in front of them. But that's not the whole problem. The problem is when you can focus a handful of police officers with close and effective supervision on a very specific number of people who have decided to make crime their lifestyle. I know that makes some people angry, but some people just choose to be criminals, right? The Ten Commandments talks about things we shouldn't have been doing since the beginning of time. So when you can focus on that handful of people, it doesn't usually take a lot to find them.
Thank you, Chief. I appreciate your time and your expertise as always. I had another question, but I saw the clock, so I got to hold it till next week. Ronald Surpass, Professor, Practice Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, hence the pregnant pause. We'll take a break, come back, talk about what's going on with the airports and air traffic controllers and DOGE and all that stuff right now. 8:30, time for WWO First News. All right, here we go, 8:46, 14 till 9. I've said this before, I spend more time cleaning up things than a janitor in a glitter factory. I misread the email from Matt Boudreaux, so let me clean this up right now when it comes to texting and GoPass, etc. What I gave you was an incorrect address. https://gopass-la.com is incorrect. That's a scam. Gopass.net is a...
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Hey, I'm Tank Sinatra here with my co-host,
Investigator Slater.
And we would like to tell you a little bit about our podcast, Psychopedia.
It's true crime infused with comedy.
Making it a crimedy.
I do extensive investigative research and go deep into the darkest corners of the human psyche.
And I'm just here to lighten things up a little bit with humor, baby. You know, never at the expense of the victims, though, obviously.
Come join our family of little psychos over on Psychopedia. Available on the Odyssey app or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Scam. It's incorrect. The fake text messages direct recipients to an unaffiliated website, and scammers will direct responses to a web address that has a hyphen in the address or one that is misspelled by one letter, as in leaving out the X in GoPass, and has a .net domain instead of a .com. So before you respond to any text message, and I sincerely apologize that I misread that, but I got a lot of information coming at me very quickly. That is an incorrect web address, so they're not going to send you a text about unpaid tolls. Leave it at that. Ignore it, and then contact DOTD yourself or OMV yourself or GoPass, G-E-A-U-X, pass yourself to see if you have any outstanding tolls, and I apologize for that. Let's talk about air traffic control and what's going on in the country. Aaron Whittle joins us now, assistant professor of practice in the Aviation and Technical Education Department at Utah State, retired veteran of the U.S. Air Force, 19 years of experience as an air traffic controller. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great, Tommy. Thanks for having me.
You know what I wanted to ask you, because I even Googled movies about air traffic controllers, and I love Pushing Tin. I don't know if you've seen it or not, with Billy Bob Thornton and John Cusack. Are there any movies that accurately capture what it is that air traffic controllers are up against and the pressure that you face?
To be honest, I have seen the show. Obviously, it's Hollywood spin on air traffic control, and it is humorous, and I do think that there are some small aspects of air traffic control that are involved in that. But no, unfortunately, I've not been able to see any shows or videos that truly display it.
So before we talk about what's going on, I want you to explain to me what it's like to be an air traffic controller, and you were one for, 19 years? Tell me what it's like when you go to work, the responsibility, when you sit behind that console, et cetera, because I don't think a lot of us understand that.
Well, I can only speak for me. And so for me personally, it matches my personality perfectly. It was a dream job for me. I get it that other individuals, it's not for them. For me, it's about attention to detail. It's always changing. It's dynamic. You can go from being slow 1 second to really quick, fast paced. You don't have time to really take a break. You're constantly on the radios talking to air traffic, and it can get really busy and stressful really quick. And so you always have to be on your A game. I always like to say, you really don't have any room for error.
Did you ever?
Not that we're perfect, but right. Man, you really got to be on it.
How much help do you have, and how easy is it to lose track of one thing or the other as an air traffic controller? Because we're all human beings.
Right. I think it's a myriad of different factors. I think that's why we rely so heavily on crew resource management, CRM. Working together is, we call it tower team concept or team concept in the approach control and center. You work together as a team, and that includes the pilot. You know, as soon as that pilot goes airborne, we're a team. We're working together to make sure everybody's safe. But yeah, there's always the human element that comes into play, and things happen sometimes, and that's unfortunate.
How long did it take you to become a competent air traffic controller, or generally speaking, for someone to become where you would trust them with, you know, and radio is minor compared to what you guys do, but, you know, it takes a lot before they trust you behind a microphone by yourself. And I'm just wondering, when it comes to air traffic control, how long does it take until they trust you to manage the air traffic around an airport?
So I think it depends on the facility that you're working in, primarily, anywhere from a year up to 4 years, 4 or 5, depending on the facility that you're working in, to be fully checked out in all positions. But I think it really depends on the individual and having that controller voice, the confidence, and that only comes with time and experience, and everybody's different. I would say for me, it took me about 3 years to really feel confident in my ability. And I think it's unique to understand that we say, well, why don't you just put that controller in another facility? Well, as soon as you move over to another facility, it's new airspace, it's new rules, it's new applications, everything changes. And so the primary rules stay the same for a tower facility. But once you go over to a terminal radar approach control facility, different rules apply. The airspace dramatically changes. There's different approaches. Altitudes change. And so there's a lot of different factors that go into it. So when we're talking about a controller getting checked out, even after years and years of experience, if you move to a new facility, it's going to take you time to get spun up to be able to learn those different rules and applications and how you need to be able to apply those things. So
let me take a quick break because I want to talk about what's going on in the country as well. And I would invite you back, Aaron, because I could pick your brain for 8 hours about this, because I think it's a very important position in the country that we take for granted. Aaron White, assistant professor of practice aviation technical education department at Utah State, 19 years experience as an air traffic controller. I wouldn't want that job. I think I could do it, but I wouldn't want it. Quick break. We'll talk about what's going on in New Jersey and more when we return. Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 8:57 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Aaron Whittle, and we're going to have him back because I could talk to him for an hour about being an air traffic controller. Aaron, tell me about what's going on in New Jersey. I see things like floppy disks, copper wires. Is it about technology? Is it about manpower? Both? Tell me what's happening in New Jersey and how concerned are you about air traffic control in the United States?
Well, I think it's something we should all be concerned with, definitely. I think there's definitely some infrastructure issues going on with some equipment. Obviously, controllers are losing radar feeds, you know, things are going down, power outages that prohibit an air traffic controller to be able to provide the service that they're required to provide. Thank goodness we have backup procedures for that, but still, when it goes out, it can be nerve-wracking for a few seconds or minutes, depending on how long it's out. But an air traffic controller is only limited to the equipment that they have. So if that goes out, I really can't provide the service that I need. And what we're seeing in New Jersey and Newark and things like that are those factors coming into play.
Is this anything that AI could eventually take over, where it would read the data, plot the different scenarios so quickly, and of course you would have to have a human there as a backup, but could that ever be applicable to this, Aaron?
I'll be honest, I do see it. For years, I've thought that to be the case. As more as equipment just gets better, I compare it to the auto industry. Mm-hmm. You know, they said, hey, we'll never be replaced by machines, and now look at it. I agree with the same way. I think to a certain degree, air traffic control can be replaced by machines.
Because what you're talking about is looking at data, interpreting it, plotting scenarios, et cetera, right, and avoiding certain outcomes, and that, to me, would be tailor-made for AI.
I agree. I think in the future, I think it'll definitely start to replace certain aspects of air traffic control.
Thank you, Aaron. We'll talk to you again because I want to pick your brain. I love talking to people and learning stuff about different things. We'll talk about the conclave when we come back. All right, 9:10, the Cardinals going to conclave in about a half an hour, maybe a little bit less. We're going to spend an hour talking about that entire thing. We have a huge Catholic population in this area, and it is a historical event. It is an event that is just steeped in tradition, and we're welcoming in Tim Gabrielli, the Gudoff Chair in Catholic Intellectual Traditions at the University of Dayton. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing quite well. How are you, Tommy?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us. I really do appreciate it. Let's talk about the practical first, I guess. They had Mass earlier, and tell me about the Cardinals themselves and the everyday logistics of it. What do? They pack a bag? They're summoned from? No, I'm serious. They're summoned from wherever they are, and they stay at a hotel. What happens?
That's totally right. Many of the cardinals had been in Rome for the funeral of Pope Francis, and typically those who are there for the funeral stay the additional 10 days or so until the conclave begins today. Those who weren't able to make it in at that time have trickled in over the intervening time, and they've been up until today, through yesterday, really, they've been having conversations called general congregations, which are really congregations, discussions about the state of the church, the state of the world, what are the kinds of questions and considerations. And so they are prepared now after, as you said, the Mass going on this morning. At some point today, after that Mass, all those cardinals will take an oath of secrecy, and everyone else will be excluded from the Sistine Chapel, and the cardinals will begin their work. During the time, they stay in the Casa San Marta, which is kind of adjacent to the Sistine Chapel. There are some folks there who care for the everyday needs of taking care of their meals and things like that, who are also sworn to secrecy, and they will stay there until we have an election.
So let me ask you this, Professor, and I think it's the elephant in the room. If all of this is shrouded in secrecy, how do we know what goes on in here?
Well, in short, we don't know what goes on, but we will know when there is an election of a pope through smoke signals, believe it or not. So they over the past week, construction workers installed a chimney, actually two chimneys inside the Sistine Chapel, out of the roof will come probably twice a day. We're expecting smoke and a color. And so if the Pope has not been elected, that smoke will be black. And when a Pope is elected, that smoke will be white. And probably about 1 o'clock Eastern time, somewhere around there, we may expect to see the first smoke come from the chimney. On the first day of the conclave, in the afternoon Rome time, the cardinals have an option that first day to do an initial ballot. The past two conclaves, the one that elected Pope Francis and the one before him that elected Pope Benedict, both did that vote on the first day, but they don't have to. So if they do proceed with that vote, we should see some smoke around 1 o'clock Eastern, I mean, odds are it will be black smoke. It would be very stunning if they elected someone on the first ballot.
That in and of itself is kind of steeped in tradition, because as I understand it, I remember as a kid my mother telling me they would burn it with wet straw or dry straw. I forgot which produced which color, but now they've actually taken to putting smoke canisters in there so there'd be no confusion, right?
That's right. Yeah, there has been.
It becomes out gray. Nobody knows what's going on.
Yeah, everybody looks at each other and says, "What is that?" Right. So they now have some chemicals that they mix in there, so that it becomes sharply black or clearly white.
I want to bring the audience into this on the Okunard Jeweler text me line at 504-260-1870. If you have any questions about the process, about the papacy, etc., we're talking to. Pardon me. All right, Dave Cohen, our news director, joins me now with a weather update, I guess. What we got?
Yeah, we have a severe thunderstorm warning
with the National.
All right, your microphone's on now.
Go ahead. The National Weather Service has just issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Orleans, Jefferson, St. Bernard, St. Charles, and Plaquemines parishes. This goes until 10:15. They say that a severe thunderstorm is now located along a line from Metairie to Barataria and moving east at 35 miles an hour. They say the storm has the potential of 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts and penny-size hail falling again in St. Bernard, St. Charles, Orleans, Jefferson, and Plaquemines parishes over the next hour, Tommy.
All right, so for the next hour, and the area is affected with a severe thunderstorm warning again, because people tend to hear
pretty much all of the South Shore. St. Bernard, St. Charles, Orleans, Jefferson, and Plaquemines.
And penny-sized hail. I know they had ping-pong ball-sized hail yesterday on the North Shore. We don't want any of that, because I had to replace a roof due to hail. And while the Cardinals are praying in the Vatican, I certainly hope they throw up a prayer that there's no severe weather or hail in Belchase, because I don't want to buy a roof. But I guess
yeah, I don't think you're on their radar
I'm
now.
I'm pretty busy with that.
60-mile-an-hour wind gusts. We could also see some damage to small structures and roofs, and we could see power outages as well.
Thank you for the next hour. Thank you, Dave Cohen, our news director. Back to Tim Gabrielli, the Gudoff Chair in Catholic Intellectual Traditions at the University of Dayton. Professor, I would imagine, you know, when you talk about the first vote, this, that, and going back to when the previous pope dies, there has to be some kind of policy and procedure manual somewhere that somebody refers to see how we go about electing a new pope?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a document that was first put together, formalized by John Paul II, who was two popes before Pope Francis, and has been revised periodically. But it specifies, I mean, you can think of it in two ways. I mean, there's the document that specifies the procedures and by which the conclave goes forward. And then there's actually a document focused on the prayer structure of the conclave. So it includes this mass. It includes the chant that the cardinals will sing, invoking the Holy Spirit as they begin. And so we should keep in mind, I think, you know, there's a sense when we think election, we think politics. And of course, there's wherever there are human beings, there are small p politics. But the cardinals really see this framed by prayer and asking God to come upon the conclave to be able to make clear to the cardinals for whom they should vote to make that next pope clear. So I think, yes, both in terms of practicalities and in terms of prayer.
As for the reality of this, and I'm not trying to offend anybody or say anything bad about anybody, but to be a cardinal, I would think you have to be a somewhat dominant kind of guy, and I would think you have to have risen through the ranks to get promoted to cardinal. And along those lines, are we dealing with, generally speaking, Professor, some pretty big egos here or what?
I would say there's a whole range of personalities. I think one of the things that was always very striking about Pope Francis was that he, you know, much was made of the fact that as a bishop, he continued to ride public transportation in Argentina. He continued to wear his worn black shoes that he had had since he was much younger, and that kind of that stood out. That kind of being one of the people. He continued to stay in the Casa San Marta, where the Cardinals will be staying instead of moving into the Apostolic Palace. He liked to be around people. He went to Mass every day with all the workers in that vicinity, and so, you know, that was a lot about his personality. Of course, it doesn't mean that if there's a cardinal who gets elected who decides to stay in the Apostolic Palace, that he is more standoffish. Maybe he's more of an introvert. But those things were striking, and I think there's a whole range of personalities among the cardinals. Some who are more gregarious and want to, you know, shake hands and be present among the people. Some who are a little more reserved. Some who are more bookish and intellectual. Some who tend to be more accessible, and so I think I wouldn't conclude that there's any particular personality. It takes all kinds.
So along those lines, you're not supposed to campaign, correct? That's against the rules, or that's discouraged?
Well, I would say it's the latter. There's no rule about it, but it is the sort of thing. If you think about it, there's this sense among the cardinals that who would really want this job to have to be in this position? And so if someone is seen as outward campaigning, that's usually a bad sign that maybe their priorities aren't in order here. But there are, of course, cardinals who are known to be advocating for others. Then they have dinner together, have conversations to get their brother cardinals to think about the possibility of a certain candidate or what gifts that he might bring to the office at this time.
Back in the day, there was a joke, you know, that people would tell in lower echelons that, you know, they would the blah, 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 is the Pope Italian? But unfortunately, that's not the case anymore, right? So we'll
right.
talk about that. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here when we come back about the constituency that will elect this new Pope, how it's changed, what it looks like, and how does that affect the actual election of the Pope? Because, again, these are very educated men, very powerful men, but they're also pragmatic men. They realize that they do have to come up with a Pope. So I just don't understand or wonder how they balance guidance with, and I guess it goes to all of us, with our relationship with God. Are we really hearing God's voice? Or are we hearing what we want to tell ourselves? We're talking to Tim Gabriella, Gudoff Chair in the Catholic Intellectual Traditions of the University of Dayton, about the Papal Conclave that's underway. Got any questions? 504-260-1870. Somebody wants to know about an age that the Pope has to be. We'll address that. And also the age of the cardinals that are taking part in the election. When we come back, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Severe thunderstorm warning is in effect until about 10:15 for Western St. Bernard, Orleans, North Central Jefferson, and Northwestern Plaquemines Parishes. Heavy rain, maybe some small hail, and winds up to 60 miles an hour. A lot of lightning as well. We just had a tremendous crash of lightning here behind me, which means I'm going to have to watch my P's and Q's. As I talk to Tim Gabrielli, Gudoff Chair in Catholic Intellectual Traditions at the University of Dayton, about the papal conclave that begins in a couple of moments here. Professor, when it comes to, and I'm looking at a history of papal elections here, 236 is from the Guardian, I guess it's true. A dove landed on the head of a priest named Fabian. The cardinals took that to be the Holy Spirit descending upon him, and he was unanimously elected Pope. Do they look to signs like that, or was that back in the year 236, and now it's a more sophisticated college of cardinals?
Well, I think signs like that, you know, could be things that cardinals might be paying attention to, but certainly there's much accountability for the process and the unfolding of the voting. And I would think if that you would, you know, ask the cardinals about it, they would say, look, God speaks to us in more mundane and regular ways, as opposed to also extraordinary signs. But they are trying to discern, you know, before the break you had mentioned, you know, how do they, you know, if you're listening for the Holy Spirit, mm-hmm. of course, there's that voice inside you that
yeah, let me refresh for the audience
direction.
that
sure,
didn't hear.
Sure.
And what I said, Professor, was that a lot of us, you know, we And that's why I'm always suspicious when I hear a politician say that they heard the voice of God. It's like, okay, well, hang on a second now. Because is that the voice of God, or is that the voice of a lobbyist, or is that the voice of you trying to convince yourself this? Tell me about the Cardinals and their thought process.
Sure. So I think that there's a long history in the church of precisely thinking about that question. It's so easy to deceive ourselves, isn't it, into thinking we've got it figured out or the answer is before us. And so, there, as I say, there's a long history in the church of thinking about this question of discernment. Discernment is being able to sort through, okay, what are the things that I'm thinking about and where is God in that? Now, it's not as easy as doing a math problem, obviously, and it's difficult. But I think we could say that these men who are cardinals have spent a lot of time on retreats throughout their life in prayer, thinking about those kinds of questions of sorting out, okay, I have this inclination. Where is that coming from? Do I bring it in prayer, and do I talk it through with my brother cardinals, and do I listen to what they're saying, or am I putting on blinders and not wanting to hear anybody else's opinion? I think those sort of practices, the great Saint Ignatius of Loyola, a founder of the Jesuits who lived in the 1500s, called this the discernment of spirits, sorting through, right? And you do that in community with others, you do that in prayer. And so I think that these folks who are cardinals in the church are well aware of those sorts of things. Now, does that mean that they're perfect? Absolutely not. Does it mean that there's no pride among them? Or no? Of course they're human beings as well. But I do think that there's a sophistication in thinking through, okay, what is God calling us to, and how might I sort that out from my own proclivities or my own inclinations?
Power has been reported 12,000 power outages in Orleans and Jefferson Parish as we sit through a severe thunderstorm warning and severe weather moving through the area. I believe Entergy knows about it immediately if it goes out, but you can notify them if you want. Let's talk about the College of Cardinals, Professor, and I'm seeing that 80% of them were appointed by Pope Francis. Is that right?
That's correct.
So what does that portend, or can we read anything into that?
Well, I think it is one of the most significant things about Pope Francis's appointment of cardinals is that he has really internationalized the cardinalate. So there are 20 countries, I believe, that have never had a cardinal before. And so there's a sense in which his emphasis on the church going to what he would often call the peripheries, those places that are overlooked, who we don't pay attention to, who we don't expect a cardinal to be from. You know, there are certain places around the world that everybody expects that you would have a cardinal from. For example, the Bishop of Venice is expected to be a cardinal, right? But what about the places that we don't pay as much attention to? Pope Francis would say, hey, we should be listening to what's going on in those places. So that's a significant thing. It's not terribly insignificant or terribly unique that he's selected a large percentage of the cardinals who are electors, simply because, you know, he was pope for 12 years, and over that time, cardinals age out of being the under 80, so therefore eligible electors, and others are appointed. I think among them, we shouldn't assume any particular ideological alignment. I think there is a range of thinking about what we should be looking for in the next pope. I do think, though, that it's safe to say that there is a sensibility among the cardinals that there are aspects of Pope Francis's papacy and initiatives that they would like to be seen as continued. I think one of the questions is, what are those aspects, right? What candidate is going to continue certain aspects of Pope Francis's papacy, and what are those aspects going to be?
When it comes to the area where the cardinals, areas where the new cardinals came from, I don't mean to be indelicate about this, Professor, but you do have to get people in the seats, right? I mean, that's what a church is about, and so when it comes to the areas where the Catholic Church is growing, would the cardinals be more likely to elect a pope from one of the areas where the church is experiencing huge growth, or where the church is struggling?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think, you know, the church is really growing in Asia. It's really growing in sub-Saharan Africa. I think there is some talk about, okay, when will the time be for another pope from Asia? I say another because in the first millennium, we had a number of popes from, you know, Syria, for example. But, you know, more recently, there hasn't been a pope from Asia or from Africa. And so is this maybe the time? It could be. One of the cardinal electors recently, Cardinal Czerny from Canada, said, you know, we're talking about, you know, particular areas or regions. We should stop speculating about that. Rather, what we're trying to do is seek a pope for 2025, wherever he comes from. So I'm sure there will be conversations about that. You know, there's always conversation about, is it time to get back to a pope from Italy? Because the last three popes have not been from Italy. You know, I have a friend in my local church who I walked by the other day, and we kind of exchanged some words about the conclave, and he's from Italy, and he said, surely it's time for an Italian. I just laughed, you know. So there is that sensibility in some ways, but I think overriding will be the question of, okay, what does the church need today? What does the world need today? And who has the gifts that are needed?
Let's talk about, when we come back, Professor, about what the Pope actually does, because he is a spiritual leader, but he's also, I think, an administrator, because he's running a pretty big, and again, I'm not trying to be offensive here, but I don't know if you want to call it a corporation, business, whatever you want to call it, an operation with a lot of assets, let's put it that way, and a lot of different holdings, a lot of different things in a lot of different areas. We'll talk about all of that when we come back. If y'all have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. Let me knock this one out real quick. Professor, is there an age range for the Pope, or can it be any of the cardinals that, or what? Or who can be Pope, matter of fact?
Yeah, that's a great question. And strictly speaking, this may be surprising. Strictly speaking, the cardinals can elect any baptized male. Now, that's but a letter of the law. Now, so but we should expect that the cardinals will elect one of their own, and typically that's from among the electors, and the electors are under the age 80. And so I think that sometimes there's questions about promising candidates who may be younger, you know, comparatively speaking, so in their late 50s or 60s, and there may be a concern there that, well, he may be Pope for a very long time, and maybe, you know, we want someone who's not going to be Pope for as long. But there isn't any restriction on an age range for the Pope.
And I don't want to get silly here, but you talk about baptized, you're talking about Catholic Church, but what about confirmation, First Communion, all that stuff that they keep the records of? You're supposed to have all that too or not?
Yeah, that'll come. Okay. So, but you know, this would be.
I understand. We're talking theoretical here because it's not going to happen. I understand that.
I just
wondered in case my name should come up. We're talking to Professor Tim Gabrielli about the conclave that's set to begin in a couple of minutes. Now we're under a severe thunderstorm warning until 10:15. 12,000 power outages in Orleans and Jefferson Parish. Be careful out there. If you have any information you want to text into us safely, you can do it. Traffic otherwise, flooded streets at 504-260-1870. We're not hearing anything right now, but if you can safely pass the information along, I'll pass it along as well. 9:37. Speaking of traffic, let's look at it right now on WWL. 9:45, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Severe thunderstorm warning in effect for just about the entire South Shore until 10:15. About 18,000 people are without power, and I'm looking at the map here, primarily Marrero and Timberlane, Tall Timbers in Algiers, St. Bernard Parish is affected, as well as some of Metairie. And I got a text from somebody, a little bit of Uptown, too, it looks like. Somebody texted in and said, will you please get to the weather? Kids are in school, and parents need to get information to them. I have had a kid in school, and I've never texted weather information to him at all, because you would think if they're in school, that's the safest place they could be. So anyway, we're telling you about the weather, and you would think, just relax. Parents, the kids are at school. That's where they're supposed to be. We're talking about the papal conclave with Tim Gabrielli, Gudoff Chair in Catholic Intellectual Traditions at the University of Dayton. So I mentioned before the break, Professor, about the Pope's got to be the spiritual leader, but he's also, I don't know, I guess, an administrator. What is the Pope's main job? Is it to run the church, or is that what the curiate does? Does he provide spiritual advice? Take me through that.
Yeah, good question. The main job of the Pope is to be the successor of Peter, the first pope, and to be the, as you say, the kind of spiritual leader of the church. But that doesn't mean he doesn't have lots of other jobs. With 1.3 billion Catholics across the world and over 300 dioceses, that's a lot. I mean, it's a lot of Catholics around the world. And the structure of the Vatican, as you described at the Curia, that's really the bureaucracy that helps to administrate the needs of those Catholics around the world, but also there's this whole arm of the Curia that's focused on humanitarian aid. So Caritas Internationalis is the second largest human aid organization after the Red Cross. So there's also that piece, right, about providing aid to folks irrespective of religion across the world. So it's a lot to manage. I think typically the cardinals are looking for someone with some good administrative experience, but that can come in a variety of contexts, and that's another question about priorities. So there are folks who have a lot of experience in diplomacy. The Vatican's diplomatic efforts have long been highly regarded. Pope John the 23rd in the 60s, for example, played a key role in the resolution of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Interestingly, we saw a meeting between the U.S. President Trump and the President of Ukraine inside the Vatican when they were there for the Pope's funeral.
And John Paul about the fall of the Soviet Union in Poland, right?
That's right. His visit to Poland is seen as a key step in the fall of the Soviet communist regime. So if you think about those ways in which the Vatican diplomatic corps does all this kind of groundwork to really make a space for things like peace talks, for things like, finding resolutions to conflict around the world. This is another element of it. So it could be someone with that kind of diplomatic experience. It could be someone who has experience heading a large diocese. It could be someone with different experience in the Curia, whether it's being involved in the dicastery that's in charge of appointing bishops throughout the world or some other. So I think that the cardinals are looking for someone who has shown administrative experience in some capacity, though that can take a variety of forms.
Can the Pope and the Curia be analogous to any U.S. president and the bureaucracy that is the U.S. government?
At some level, of course, because it's an organization of human beings. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the main differences is, there are a couple. One, I think Curia means court, the court of a king or a queen. And so there's a long history here, and there's a way of operating in the Curia that maybe is a little different than we think about how a government operates. There's a kind of expectation of certain kinds of interplay among those folks and insiders who know the ropes and others who do not. So I think there's that, but there's also the way in which Catholicism across the world really does look different. Of course, there's unity, but it really does look different in different parts of the world. And so having a sense of that goes even beyond, I would say, having a sense of how things look different in different states in the U.S. It really is does require an ability to know the church in those places that is somewhat distinct.
One quick final question. How does each pope change the papacy? Is the next pope going to have to be more of a down-to-earth pope because of the model that Francis set, or is each pope individual in and of themselves, can go back to the Benedict with the red shoes and the trappings of office, etc.?
Yeah, I think it's anybody's guess. The Italians have this saying that, a skinny pope follows a fat pope, which means, that there's always, you should always expect some kind of contrast. I don't know that always holds up, whether it's in style or substance. I think that sometimes we even tended to overplay the contrast between Pope Francis and Pope Benedict. They were continuous in a number of ways, though of course they had some differences. I think it could be the case. I wouldn't be surprised if it's someone who really continues a lot of Pope Francis's initiatives, but maybe was a bit more reserved. You know, in the middle of the 20th century, we saw John the 23rd, who was known as Pope of Surprises, called the Second Vatican Council, in many ways had a personality that was sort of like Pope Francis's. And then that was followed by Pope Paul the VI, who continued a number of priorities from John the 23rd, but tended to be a bit more reserved personality, maybe a bit more perspicacious in thinking through issues. So that could be the case, to follow that model. But we really don't know. There is that enduring mystery of the conclave, and we'll see what emerges.
You're comfortable picking a timeline or not?
Well, I think that, I mean, there's folks who have said this will probably be quick, it'll probably be long. If I were a betting man, my money would be that it would take a few days. I would think maybe a little longer than what the conclave that elected Pope Francis, which was on the third day. I wouldn't be surprised if it went past the break. On Saturday, if a pope has not been elected, the cardinals will take a break, no ballots that day, for prayer, for conversation, and I wouldn't be surprised if we make it through that, because these cardinals really need to get to know one another. And of course, that process has started, but they need to get to know one another because, again, they're from across the globe, even more diverse group than we've had previously, and they haven't met together all that often. Now, I think if it goes on for days, there is a pressure that builds, you know, that the cardinals don't want to be perceived as being deeply divided or unsure, and so there's a pressure that builds over time. But I wouldn't be surprised if it takes until early next week. Though, of course, now that I've said that, I'm sure I'll be wrong.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time and insight. Professor Tim Gabrielli, Gudoff Chair in Catholic Intellectual Traditions at the University of Dayton. Severe thunderstorm warning until 10:15 today. It appears as though the worst of it has gone through downtown. 18,000 people without power. Jefferson Orleans Parish will give you the update and let you know everything you need to know here on WWL throughout the day. Taking a quick break, then we'll find out what Newell's got for us on WWL.